You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After a long review process, the New York City Council will vote on the controversial NYU 2031 expansion plan tomorrow. Over the last several months, Greenwich Village residents, NYU faculty, and urban planning experts have weighed in on the project, and last week a group of prominent writers and artists, many of them village residents, contributed essays to a book called While We Were Sleeping, NYU and the Destruction of New York. I'm pleased to welcome three of them to our show now. Peter Carey, two-time winner of the Man Booker Prize, Jessica Hagedorn, winner of the American Book Award, John Guare, winner of the Tony and Olivier Awards, and I'm pleased to welcome you all back, and congratulations on all the awards. I know there were many others as well. Peter, this book is billed as a collection of pieces in protest. Is there a literary tradition for this kind of work?
No, there may well be. I mean, the sort of tradition I'm aware of is that you're at home and the phone rings and someone wants you to do something and you try desperately not to do it. So the tradition for me is really saying, can't Edgar Doctorow really do this? And wouldn't Philip Levine be better? And so my involvement in this sort of thing follows a tradition of trying not to be involved. However, in the end, there is no choice, and this is a really important thing for our community.
And E.L. Doctorow and Philip Levine and Jules Feiffer and Kenneth Lonergan and Lynn Tillman and many others, Jessica here, are most of the contributors people who don't normally engage in political protests, like you, Peter?
Well, I think, you know, there are very few people that can be as politically engaged as their ideas and principle would suggest that they should be. And then, of course, there are things that happen in our life where it's impossible to do nothing. And this is an occasion where it is impossible to do nothing.
Jessica, is that what convinced you to contribute a piece?
Well, because I've been a longtime village resident, and I've taught at NYU, so there's that past connection, and I walk by those buildings every day. But, you know, I was also thinking about your first comment, is there a long tradition? And usually we're asked to sign petitions and things like that. But I think what has been wonderful about this book is because they could do it as a fast book, that we can do that now. I think that really intrigued me. I was in the middle of moving, as a matter of fact, and really packing boxes when I got the email, and I thought, oh my God. But the idea that we're all going to be in this book together and they could do it like that was a new thing.
Moving to another place in the village?
Yes, I did move two blocks away. Yeah.
You were born in Manila.
Yes.
Is there anything similar to Greenwich Village in Manila?
There are pockets where artists live that become sort of that hub for a moment, but the same thing happens there. You know, people come in and they start tearing the old wonderful homes down. And I think this is something many people can relate to all over the world, actually.
John, how long have you lived in the village?
Almost 50 years. I mean, I've had the same phone number since the mid-60s. I lived on 10th Street and Bank Street and 12th Street in the last 30, all those decades of years.
Do you still use the name rather, like Oregon 5 rather?
On my answering machine, I still say CH2.
I love it.
So where you were born in New York?
I was born in Manhattan.
But not in the village. What brought you to the village?
The village brought me to the village because the village was where I was everything I would read about. I discovered Eugene O'Neill. I learned about the village.
Mm-hmm.
The village just seemed to be the touchstone of it's where the off-Broadway movement was starting. When I was about 15, I went to see Wonderful Town, the Leonard Bernstein, Cameron Green show. But the first song was, you know, they sang, that was in 1953, and they sang, interesting people living on Christopher Street. Here we live, right in the heart of Greenwich Village. And by the intermission, I said, I know that's where I'm going to live. And I moved there as soon as I got out of the Air Force and came to New York.
In your essay, you're right, Greenwich Village is an idea that NYU should not be able to buy.
That's right.
What is that idea, the whole notion of the counterculture?
The idea of that there is an alternate culture in American life. I started getting really sitting up and watching, and I mean, I've worked at NYU, and I mean, I, you know, I'm, you know, I have my library card at NYU, but I started to realize that NYU was behaving like I would realize the Koch brothers, or you know, the first time I became aware of that billionaire philosophy that if I have the money and I have the power, I can do whatever I want to. And the Provincetown Playhouse, which is where Sam Shepard and I had our first commercial run, double bill in 1968, that was this theater where the American theater started. The modern American theater started was thanks to Eugene O'Neill and the Provincetown Playhouse. And the interior of that theater was sacred. It had the original set, for the Robert Jones set for Emperor Jones was still part of, was still the stage. And you had to work around that. And it was thrilling. And NYU, in an expansion, the law school or something, just decimated the interior of the theater. There was a review process that they just dismissed. And at that time, I said, that was the first time I realized. I said, oh, NYU just doesn't care. History is something for school and education, which is about teaching us about our history. NYU doesn't care about our history. They have no idea of that which is sacred.
Well, I mean, NYU claims actually they preserved it, but saying that's not true.
They preserved it by destroying it.
Now, I want to follow up on some of the things that you've said and throw it out to everybody here. You're suggesting that a major part of all of this is history, but we associate Greenwich Village with the counterculture. Does that metaphor still apply when most of the people who personify the counterculture have moved to the East Village, the Lower East Side, Long Island City, or the hot areas of Brooklyn because they can no longer afford to live in Greenwich Village unless they have a rent-controlled apartment or have a lot of money?
As Jessica said very perceptibly, that even in Manila, when the artists come to a place and rescue it, as has happened in Soho, then people come in and people come in and suddenly the real estate values, people say, oh, I have to live here. This is, the artists have made it hip. The artists have made it a magnet. My idea of what the, when I say the idea of Greenwich Village is an idea, it's in this corporate America, this white Anglo-Saxon Protestant America, that it, like Harlem, Greenwich Village has always been the idea of the other America, the part of America that the American establishment is afraid of.
Now, Peter, when you came here from Australia, did you move to the village first?
Yeah, I did.
Because you had a job at NYU or because of the what the village represented?
I had a job at NYU, which I swore I wouldn't take, and then found myself taking. So, yes. And also I'd house swap with Israel Horovitz, who lived on 11th Street. So I lived there for a little while.
So the theater thing, we have
I wasn't drawn to New York all around here now. I didn't really want to come to the village. I didn't know very much about the village at all, except that record cover with Bob Dylan on the freewheeling Bob Dylan, which I guess is in the village. But I found the village and came to love the village very much.
You still live there?
Well, I'm south of Houston now, but I still walk through the designated site for the destruction of parts of the village, which by Silver Towers and that lovely garden. Is it the Sasaki Garden?
Sasaki, I believe.
We're going to talk about that in a moment. Yeah. We have to take a little break. Mm-hmm. When we come back, let's talk about that and what the expansion project entails, which includes the Sasaki Garden and some other things. I'm talking to three of the contributors to a book called While We Were Sleeping, NYU and the Destruction of New York. Some of the other contributors, David Amram, Kevin Baker, Jules Pfeiffer, Daniel Golson, Roberta Brandes-Gratz, right. Joel Gray, Nat Hentoff, incredible list here. My guests, Peter Carey, John Guare, and Jessica Hagedorn. Stay with us for more. With me are three contributors to a new book called While We Were Sleeping, NYU and the Destruction of New York. They are Jessica Hagedorn, Peter Carey, and John Guare. And let's talk about that subtitle, NYU and the Destruction of New York. Isn't that a bit harsh?
No.
No,
I don't think it's harsh.
Not when you're having when you're building the equivalent of the interiors of the Empire State Building in three locations. In Central, I mean, the size of it. The village has always been about human scale.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
The scale of the way. There was one time I remember in the 60s where Zeckendorf really had a project where he said, if people like the low buildings in New York, I'm going to build a platform over Manhattan and build skyscrapers on top of it. And that was really seriously considered for a while in the 60s. That, in a sense, is what. You just have to stand in Washington Square Arch and look downtown and see the way that the glut of the mediocrity of NYU buildings has just destroyed the view of the village. We're not talking about the aesthetics of it. We're talking about the essential character of a village within New York City is being eradicated.
And what we need for life, and John was talking about, you know, the height of buildings, you know, and can you see the cloud? How much, what value do you put on that cloud that you can see? What value do you put on that little garden that you choose to walk past? Well, we can sort of be called Luddites because we're for keeping those things, but, you know, I think one of the really interesting things that rich people do, they do tend to, say, live near Central Park and all of that green, and they do tend to go out to the Hamptons, and if they really got enough money, like the mayor, they have a helicopter to go out there, and they've got all the blue
to Bermuda. The mayor,
wherever
to Bermuda.
The thing about low rise building is really, really important to our mental health and to have a civilized society.
And Jessica, John suggested it's also the quality of architecture that's in question.
Yes, I mean, certainly I live in the far West Village, and as you know. You all know what's going on there, and it's amazing I'm still there. And I do believe, by the way, many of my neighbors are longtime villagers, and I think we're hanging on because we love the idea that this place has all that history. I mean, you know, I'm down by the river, and
well, that's where most of the new building.
That's where
the
new buildings are, but it still makes me feel good to see that the kids from the Bronx are still coming down there to dance at the pier because that is where they are, you know, allowed to feel like they can be themselves. So, but let's see, maybe they'll be moved away too because they're not what people want to look at. But why are we still here and why do we care? I'm an urban person and, you know, I don't fly off to the Hamptons. I couldn't care less about it. I want my city to have a little bit of everything and to be diverse, and it's getting less and less so.
But it's been pointed out that this kind of development is going on all over the city, especially in Lower Manhattan, at a time when most of the country is suffering from a drop in real estate values. Isn't it a good thing that New York is booming?
My model of the way a city is treated, my wife has a job that takes us to Rome a number of months of the year, and the way Rome modernized.
Poor John Guare.
I'm so lucky. I'm to live in the village
and to go to Rome. Yes.
Which complement each other in some great way. But Rome understands that it is its essential character that attracts people to it.
Right.
And all the modernization is done from within. There are no, in the central part of Rome, Il Centro, there are no tall buildings. Everything is the building. They're all 3, 4, 5, 6 stories high. And all the tall buildings are way out in another part called Ayer, another section of Rome. And the way that essential character of Rome has been protected by wise planning, by wise protection of what it is. I mean, NYU is killing the golden goose. All these kids that they want to attract to NYU are coming to NYU because they see these images of what the village is, of what they'll be part of, the tradition that they'll be part of, from O'Neill down to, you know, Bob Dylan to whoever, you know. They're part of that tradition. And NYU, and when these kids get there, they're going to see that all that will be left in these massive buildings and these dormitories will be glamorous black and white photographs of what used to be there.
Absolutely.
And it's killing the goose that laid the golden egg, which is what, you know, you talk about development today, how good it is. Yes, there's a way to develop, but not a way to develop and destroy. And NYU has this mastery of saying, yes, we destroyed the interior of the Provincetown Playhouse in order to protect it. That's not an argument.
The scale of those buildings, you know, do something very, very important for the village and for community. I'd lived in many places in the world, Australia particularly, in small towns and big cities, And living in the village was the first time in my entire life I experienced a really dense web of community from people of all sorts of all types, who gathered on their stoops and talked to each other. And that was a huge part of living in Greenwich Village. The 2 million square feet that NYU want to erect are not going to produce that sort of a community. You're going to produce an alienated, lonely community with that sort of architecture.
So let's talk about some of the architecture. The proposed development area is currently home to two apartment complexes, Washington Square Village and Silver Towers. The Silver Towers, designed by architect I.M. Pei, now is landmark, so that can't be touched. Part of their tower in the park design involves a lot of open space around the towers. Why doesn't their landmark status prevent large-scale buildings from being built right next to them?
I don't know.
That's a very good question, because it's the developer, because it's the people who have the money. Get in there. The people who have the money protect. People do not want landmark status. Developers hate landmark status because it bars them in some way. It stifles their creativity.
And also, you have to ask yourself, do they need these buildings?
Yes.
83% of them are for administrative. They're not for students.
Well, they're saying they need them, and Columbia, of course, is saying the same thing uptown. Are these situations analogous?
Yes. That's why I think this book is important, and I think the harshness, perhaps, as you call it, of the title was absolutely necessary. And I think, you know, all this development...
Because you see precedent here?
Yeah. And I think it's taking over neighborhoods and driving away the people who've been there, you know, with families and communities, and without any sort of regard for that.
Yeah. So what are you suggesting, that they build all the ugly buildings along the waterfront in Williamsburg?
Well, they act like good neighbors. How about like that? And how about
listening to the people who live in the neighborhood and to their own faculty who are against this?
This is
expansion.
The university. NYU is actually not the trustees who actually are meant to be entrusted with the care of NYU. Certainly not John Sexton, who is appointed or serves at the pleasure of the trustees, I do believe.
Yes.
So when we see what NYU are doing, we've got to think about what the faculty are doing and what the faculty want. And what you see, this extraordinary thing in a university where the great majority of NYU's faculty, that's 37 departments, have majority votes against this development. Now, who are the trustees acting for?
Not exactly.
The thing that they're selling, because what they're selling is those people, those extraordinary brains, those gifted teachers, those dedicated teachers. This is who they're meant to be serving.
And Philip, one thing is, who is going to pay for this? That has never been decided. And the one thing that will happen is that NYU, which keeps raising its tuition, will have fewer and fewer scholarship students, and will become more and more a place for people who can pay top dollar to go to.
Right.
Because this will be paid for on the backs of the students.
Now, a faculty member, Patrick Deere, has called in. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Thanks so much.
Are you agreeing with everything you're hearing?
I'm agreeing strongly. First of all, I'd like to thank and congratulate your guests on their brilliant contributions to the book, which is a great book. And just like to strongly echo what has been said about the need for NYU to act like good neighbors to the community and also to its faculty. I'm a member of a very large faculty group that's opposed to this expansion. And in addition to questions of the potentially devastating environmental impact of 20 years of construction on these two residential blocks, we've really not been consulted about NYU's rationale for the plan. I mean, we know we need more classrooms and labs to serve our students, but this is really not a rational or measured response to NYU's space needs, and it's really going to put a tremendous amount of strain on the faculty, the neighborhood, and our students. It's a 20-year construction plan. And the faculty, we presented an alternative, a green alternative, fairly late in the game, true, but because we weren't consulted by the administration. And the city council members we were talking to asked us about an alternative. And we think that NYU can really answer its space needs by doing what it's always done, dispersing its... we don't need to build and concentrate in a core. That's the kind of densification approach, as they describe it in their plan, that really belongs to the past.
Thank you for calling us, Patrick.
Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick.
Now, you mentioned earlier the Sasaki Gardens. Two other buildings will be built on land now occupied by a playground and the Sasaki Gardens, which were designed by Hideo Sasaki, one of the first rooftop gardens built over a parking garage. Isn't that garden of historic interest? Has it ever been given landmark status? Do you know?
I don't think it has, and I could be wrong. I mean, that could be somebody here might know more than I about the landmark status of that. But
no, I don't know. I lived there when I first came to New York, and that was the place. That was a treasure. You couldn't believe that you found such a sort of a jewel in the middle of the city.
Now, do you think that if they had come up with a plan that was visually appealing and seemed to blend in with the neighborhood better than the current proposal does, that you would be more willing to accept it?
I think the one thing is the 20-year construction,
yeah,
the absence of money, knowing where the money is coming from. I mean, just putting our community on hold for not one year, not two, but for 20 years of obliteration, that there's with no guarantees, and those trustees will long die off. And there'll be new people coming in. They'll say we have to have even more space because there's nothing there, and we have to destroy what's there in order to preserve it.
And we've got a big debt. We've built a big debt.
The reason I asked that is exactly. Patrick Deer, who called earlier, mentioned that he's part of an NYU faculty group that's proposed an alternative green plan.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that some city council members will be considering that as part of a compromise that I suspect will be arrived at. But Jessica, you're suggesting that you don't want any compromise. You want the whole thing to just stop?
I think it should stop for now. We're in a recession. I don't understand this at all.
I disagree. I think that this is a time for thinking about the future, saying how are we going to expand, but as Patrick said, not in the densification, not clustering. As a little girl said at the community hearing last week, she said, I'm 12 years old and I have to get on a subway to go to school every day and take a long trip. Why does NYU have to be all around? Why can't they take the subway?
But NYU actually has been building in Midtown as well, and some people have been
and
upset
I think that they're also
that.
Building in Dubai and they're building around the world, and I think that they should put their efforts up to expand. They want to become a global outfit.
They can bring freedom to Dubai. That'd be great.
Yes.
There's a lot of space to expand in Dubai, isn't there? Or is that the place of little islands? I don't know.
I think the whole issue here that we're not questioning is, and which Dubai helps, is the whole concept of growth, where we've sort of grown up. This is a sort of a positively 19th century or even 18th century idea that growth is good and we will get, our lives will get better and everything will grow and everything will get grow. And don't make me sort of do the sort of cancer cell analogy because that would be really cheap.
I won't ask you.
But we do know by now, or many of us know, that, the planet itself is an already overstressed system, and we keep on putting pressure on it. It will break. New York City is also going to follow those same sort of rules. We should be talking about how we limit growth, and we can't just keep on making things denser and denser and denser until we suffocate and die.
Well, NYU has 13 campuses around the world. Of course, the argument is that it gives students an opportunity to also study in other environments.
But I am not here to make NYU's life fabulous. There are other people who live in this city, and there are other people who live in the neighborhood. It's not about making NYU have whatever it wants.
Well, it's like NYU is occupied. It's like a bloodless coup. They've just occupied the village.
They claim that people come to the Village because of NYU. Others claim that NYU's appeal is because it's in the Village. Just one more thing, because we've run out of time. This book is unusual in that it doesn't list a publisher, just that it was printed by McNally Jackson, a local bookstore. So how can people get a copy of this book?
You go to the bookstore or...
Any bookstore?
No, to McNally Jackson. Uh-huh. And or you can... order it, I believe.
And I believe that they are planning to distribute it in other downtown bookstores.
Oh, great.
And whatever you pay for this book, which is open up to you, goes to help fight this awful plan. So $20 would be, I would recommend, as a good price, but you can buy it, I think, for $9.
It's a donation, yeah.
The book is While We Were Sleeping, NYU and the Destruction of New York, a collection of pieces in protest, with pieces by Kevin Baker, Yale Doctoral, Jules Pfeiffer, Joel Gray, Philip Levine, Kenneth Lonergan, Joseph McElroy, Eileen Miles, Lynn Tillman, and many others. And my three guests today, Peter Carey, John Guare, and Jessica Hagedorn. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.